Good morning. So this is welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today's date is December 2nd, 2020. We have six matters on our calendar today. Before I go any further, I just want to make sure that the attorneys that have appeared today are able to hear me and that we are able to hear you. So I'll start just because that's who I see on my screen with Mr. Norrie. Would you just unmute yourself and verify that, please?
Good morning, Your Honor. Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Becker?
Your Honor, I can hear.
Very good. And Mr., do I say it correctly? Is it Puklich? Please help.
Puklich.
All right. Puklich. Okay. Thank you very much. And it sounds like you can hear us as well.
I can. Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Very good. And then I'll ask the marshal just to call the court into session, and then I'll have a few remarks before we call this case, the first case. So, Mr. Marshal, would you call us into session, please?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Bradfield, Judge Werke, Judge Riley, the Honorable Judge Bradfield presiding, now calling State of Minnesota, ETAL, versus Nelson Auto Center, Inc., ETAL. Case number A200653.
All right. And counsel, before we begin arguments, I'll make just a very few remarks. First of all, I want to welcome you today. We are very much looking forward to hearing the argument in this case, and we appreciate the briefs that have been submitted by all of you in this matter. Secondly, I just want to remind you that before you begin your remarks, everything we're doing today is being recorded, and it's recorded for a purpose, so we have a record and are able to refer to it. It's also is made available, the audio recording, on our website. So if you would identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you start your remarks. And then third, please keep an eye on the clock. That should be visible to all of you. It does go quickly during these arguments. And if you have any questions about the clock, please alert us right away. The same with regard to our virtual argument today. I know you all are aware of ways to let us know if you're having trouble with connectivity. So please avail yourselves of that if anything happens during the course of the argument, and we will make allowance accordingly based on time. So we've had the first matter called today, and I'm aware that we have two respondents' briefs filed, and it sounds like, and maybe I even heard it and I've forgotten it already, I believe the respondents are sharing time, the 15-minute time block. I don't recall what the agreement is on the amount of time and how you're going to do that. So if one of the respondents' counsel would let me know that, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll be speaking for 13 minutes and Mr. Puklich will be speaking for 2 minutes.
Very good. And so the marshal will adjust the clock accordingly when you start your remarks. So with that, I think we're ready to proceed. Mr. Becker, your counsel for appellant. So if you'd begin by identifying yourself and the client you represent. Thank you.
Yeah. For the record, my name is Mark Becker and I represent Stephen Kleiber. He is the QTAM relator and the whistleblower in this case. May it please the court, I can start my argument. Okay. Thank you. As I said, appellant Mr. Kleiber is the whistleblower pursuing defendants as QTAM relator on behalf of 248 individual public entities, including cities, counties, and other public entities across the state of Minnesota, for the defendant's liability under the Minnesota False Claims Act on more than 3,000 overbilled Ford car police car transactions that were based on state contract forms. We're here today to request respectfully a clean and complete reversal of the lower court's decision, which dismissed our claims on the basis of res judicata because there was an ADR process between admin and Nelson Auto. One of the things that I wanna highlight for you—
Mr. Beckham, before you highlight, I need to understand this. This case, in my opinion, has many, many thorny issues, but I'm not sure that we even get to all of the issues. And this is what I don't understand. You were dismissed on your pleadings under res judicata. So tell me about your pleadings. You have 248 public entities that, and then you have the arbitration that included 128. So tell me how this mix match happened. Why were these other entities not a part of the arbitration? How were the entities in your complaint not provided with notice of the arbitration? That's the heart of your case.
Yeah, I want to correct what I think is an assumption that you made.
Good, that's what I want you to do.
Of the 128 entities who are referenced in the award, only one was an actual party to the arbitration, and that was Admin. The other 127 and the 120 that weren't mentioned at all in the arbitration were not party to that arbitration. They did not.
Well, then explain to me how that arbitration works. Why, what should have happened for them to be parties, or what would, that's what I'm getting at. I don't understand the procedure of all of that.
Well, the procedure is that if a party wants to agree to an ADR process, they have to consent.
I get that. But how are these parties interrelated that one party was deemed suitable to stand and speak for all of the parties involved?
That's the flaw, is they didn't have the authority to speak for all of the parties involved. And that's the heart of our case, is that Admin was an independent actor that acted without the authority or approval of any of the other cities, counties.
Well, certainly Admin would be the umbrella, you know, like a father or a parent, the umbrella to all of these other entities, wouldn't it be? Or if so, why not?
That is incorrect. And that's the heart of the issue. And I think where the district court got it wrong. The state contract that Admin establishes through the public procurement process is just a standardized form that Nelson Auto was to use to sell cars to other cities and counties. Each one of those purchase orders is a new and independent contract that's established between Nelson Auto and the city or the county, as the case may be. Whoever is the buyer of the car, that is the contractual relationship. It's solely between the purchaser and Nelson Auto. Admin is a stranger to those purchase contracts. All they do is establish the form to be used. And Nelson Auto agrees to honor that form for each of the cities and counties to whom they sell contracts. But the flaw in the arbitration process, and I think what the main flaw is below, was that the court conflated the contractual relationships between the party and assumed that Admin was actually a party to the individual sales contracts, and they were not. They were a stranger to that contract.
So, Mr. Becker, I have a follow-up, and I appreciate your explanation for how the contracts work. As one of the points that I think is made in the respondent's brief is that there are two contracts and everything flowed from two contracts. And there are actually more than two contracts, and you explained that really well right now. But some of those contracts involve state entities, right? You've also said that. So for instance, there were purchases actually made for sure by various Minnesota departments of safety, for instance, right? Because most of these are, or maybe all of them are police vehicles, State Highway Patrol. I don't know, did DOA actually purchase some vehicles through these standardized contracts?
Yeah, I believe that they did.
Okay.
So
here's my question for you. I thought I understood that. So those claims were also resolved in the arbitration, the purchases that were done by the state entities, correct?
I would disagree with that.
Okay, so there was never a reimbursement made by Nelson to the state entities?
Not in full, as we've alleged in our complaint.
No, just I want to know, was there any reimbursement made by Nelson to the state entities?
The award did contemplate that they would make that reimbursement. Whether that actually occurred, I don't know that.
So that would be a matter for discovery?
Yes.
And so have you made an allegation in your complaint that Nelson did not follow the terms of the arbitration award?
I don't know if we've said it like that, but we certainly have made the allegation that they haven't returned all of the money due the public entities.
Right. And I realize you're another core of your argument is that the arbitration did not acquire the damages that this group of plaintiffs is entitled to based on your analysis under the Minnesota False Claims Act, right?
Correct.
Yeah, if everything you say is true, which of course we give you the benefit of that at this point of the pleadings. So here's what I'm trying to understand. So let's say we do reverse, give you what you're asking for and send this case back for discovery and for perhaps summary judgment, we'll see. Is this a case where you would envision that you in fact do continue to represent the state entities as well as these individual political subdivisions, cities and counties?
We would represent all of the parties who were the victims of the overbilling scheme.
Let me ask you that. I thought that was your answer. So if that's true, you know, and for instance, the Department of Administration during the arbitration did get a reimbursement from Nelson, they're not going to be able to double dip, are they, and get the reimbursement again?
Well, so let me just explain, if I may, how the False Claims Act works. Certainly, we're asking for additional amounts that weren't identified. That's the excess over the total bid constant. But under the False Claims Act, the statute provides for treble damages, civil penalties, and attorney's fees. And at no time in that ADR process was there any discussion of the False Claims Act or the...
Want you to answer my question though, Mr.
Yes.
I want to know about the damages, the direct damages from these false contracts, not the the additional damages that the parties are entitled to under the False Claims Act.
They would get a credit. The defendants would get a credit for those partial payments. Absolutely. 100%.
Okay. I need another frame it up kind of question. So the public entity plaintiffs that you're speaking for, they were able to participate in the CPV, the Cooperative Purchasing Ventures. By virtue of them participating, wouldn't they be bound then by whatever arbitration, in this case, that the administration engaged in? Because that's what I'm getting at, is they're all kind of coming in under that realm of being.
This is a good question. The Cooperative Purchasing Venture is authorized by a specific statute that we cited, but that venture is a joint powers agreement and is subject to the joint power statute. And if you look at the joint power statute, it's very clear that the parties maintain their individual responsibilities for their own acts or omissions, and that one party's act or omissions is not going to be binding on another party, not without the express authority, which in this case didn't exist because there wasn't any consent by any of the public entities other than admin. There wasn't any consent by them to participate in this ADR process.
I'd like to follow up on this comment you made about consent. So this is a matter in which there was a number of checks issued by Nelson, and there was the use of this reimbursement acceptance form. And I appreciate that you've explained well in your brief how you view that form. But there are a number of entities that accepted these checks from Nelson and signed the form, which seems to indicate that they have resolved their claim for reimbursement for these overbillings. So what effect do we give that form? Does that form, you know, if an entity has signed that form, say the city of Bagley, and I'm just pulling that name out of thin air. So they probably have not signed such a form, but if they had, does that form mean that they have acquiesced in the arbitration and the prior negotiations that took place between Nelson and these public entities?
I do not believe so, because if you look at the forms, they don't say anything about an arbitration process, nothing about it. There's certainly not a full disclosure of the basis.
Right. No, I'm not saying they've released. I'm not saying it's the same as a release, but you already said that Nelson would get credit for any reimbursement that was accepted. So I'm just trying to understand legally why you say that.
Yes, we've cited the case in our briefs. It's the Supreme Court case, the Bornstein case, that talks about the specific issue. For purposes of the False Claims Act, the way you calculate the damages is you take the base damage, you multiply it, you add the civil penalties, and then you credit back any prior reimbursements. And that's actually a common thing in the False Claims Act because, you know, many times there's a criminal aspect to this that might go before the False Claims Act. And there, as part of the criminal proceeding, there might be a restitution order. And so those restitutionary payments would be a credit against the claim. And that's in essence what happened here, because Warner pled guilty to the felony here. he hasn't paid any civil penalties.
I didn't see in the record where his restitution amount was. Is that, I don't know what he was ordered to pay for restitution. It's not in the record, I don't think.
I don't believe it is in the record.
The record in the pleadings that we're looking at.
Yeah.
And then Mr. Becker, as a follow-up to Judge Riley's question, if in fact a restitution order was cut, it would have to list the individual victims, would it not? And who would they have been?
It's a good question. I don't believe that the restitution by Mr. Warner was to specific entities. I believe my understanding of the record is the restitution payment he made was directly to Nelson Otto.
Could you say, I didn't hear you, you were-
The restitution payment that I understand Mr. Warner made was directly to Nelson Otto, but not to the individual entities who were the victims.
So as I understand it, prior to the arbitration, Nelson Otto cut 230 checks to purchasers, public entities. I don't think in the pleadings we know, or on the record that we can look at, that we know who those people are. And then after the arbitration, they cut another 128 checks, totaling almost $1 million. Is that right?
I believe so, Your Honor. But I want to direct your attention to the award, because the award talked about restitution payments on the Chrysler transactions that are not a part of this case. And so when we're comparing apples to apples,
complaining about the money that Nelson paid to Ford also.
Yeah, I wouldn't count that, because that wasn't Ford's money. It was the public entity's money based on our analysis.
But you're saying that the arbitration dealt with Chrysler, I think I just heard you say, but it also dealt with some of the Ford contracts.
It did deal with some of the Ford contracts, but as it relates to the $200,000 thereabouts referenced in the award, it's impossible to tell from the award whether it was for Chrysler's or Ford's. It doesn't allocate that way.
So, Mr. Becker, I'd like to follow up a bit on Judge Riley's question about the 230 checks that were issued before the arbitration. Did any of those have to do with Ford?
I believe some of those did. Yes. And again, that would be a credit against their overall false claims liability, but it wouldn't exonerate them from their false claims liability. I want to just have you focus on the Seventh Circuit Court case that we cited, the Lusby opinion, that really talked about the role of res judicata in the false claims context, and that in the False Claims Act, it's such an important statute to police the public procurement that you really should avoid the situation where we are wiping out the buyers, the public entities, their claims under the False Claims Act unwittingly because there wasn't a false claims addressed in the underlying proceeding. And so I really think that doing that here would work an injustice. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Becker. Much appreciated. And of course, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to. So I think with that, we're ready to begin with the respondents. And Mr. Norrie, I think you said you were starting.
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, my name is Jonathan Norrie from the Bassford Remley firm. I represent the Nelson Auto Center, Brent and Laurel Nelson, Melissa Nelson, Melissa Larson, and Sue Kugler, who are some of the respondents in this matter. May it please the court. The vehicle contract issues in this case have already been resolved. They were resolved years ago. In 2018, following two audits by the BCA and then the Department of Administration, Nelson Auto paid more than $800,000 to the state and its subdivisions. And then in 2019, following a binding arbitration before retired federal magistrate judge Art Boylan, Nelson Auto paid about another $250,000 to the state and its subdivisions to resolve all claims and any issues that could have been brought regarding the vehicle contracts. Those payments have been made. Those checks have been cashed. There's no allegation that that did not occur.
But Mr. Norrie, by your own argument, you arbitrated the subject matter of two audits. And what I'm understanding that Mr. Kleber brought forward to counsel Mr. Becker is that there was other things that had not been investigated that aren't a part of an audit. Wouldn't they still be out there swinging in the wind?
No, Your Honor, because the arbitration award very clearly says that it relates to all issues and any claims relating to the 6-5 and 6-9 umbrella contracts. So those are the two umbrella contracts under which everything else flows, and the arbitration resolved anything that was or could have been brought relating to them.
So through this, as I understand it, there was the BCA and Edmund did audits 1 and 2. And as a result of that, Nelson cut checks of almost $800,000 to $230,000. Then other stuff comes to light. They do a third audit. They could not resolve the issues with the third audit, and the arbitration dealt with what came out at that third audit. Is that right?
Well, the arbitration started with that, but the arbitration award reflects four separate issues that Judge Boylan considered. And the arbitration award specifically lists those four issues. And again, at that point, the arbitrator is saying, I am resolving any and all claims relating to the 6-5 and the 6-9 contracts that are, okay, again, the—
Now, Mr. Noria, this is where I want to inject my what bothers me about this. And again, I understand your agreement says this covers everything under the sun that has to do with this, but don't we ever look at some concepts or maxims like unclean hands? Was there anything in there that said Nelson Auto has disgorged or disclosed all, you know, all matters that, I mean, if there's, it's like a shell game. If there's something hidden, why wouldn't we set aside that arbitration agreement and say these issues are still right?
Because, Your Honor, the state of Minnesota, which is again the umbrella here, agreed to this arbitration to resolve any and all claims. And it had the ability to do exactly that. It had the ability to get additional information, but it chose to resolve everything. And I think what Your Honor is really focusing on here is the concept of privity, right? Because the idea is here that the state is in privity with its subdivisions. And I think you were getting at this with your observation about when you use the term umbrella. So the entire point of the cooperating purchasing venture statute is to give the subdivisions the benefit of letting the state negotiate these kind of umbrella agreements. They get the benefit of having the state be able to set up an entire system in which these subdivisions benefit by getting lower prices. So the state enters into the 6-5 and 6-9 agreements for the benefit of the CPV members, for the benefit of the subdivisions. And of course, it is in the state's interests to ensure compliance with those contracts. And when it does that, that directly benefits the subdivisions. But here, more than that, we know that the state acted in the arbitration specifically for the—
Mr. Norrie, before you get to the arbitration, in terms of the contracts themselves, as Mr. Becker discussed, we have these two overarching contracts that DOA negotiated, but then we have the subsequent purchases by the individual political entities. That's right, isn't it? That there are actually many, many contracts involved in this dispute.
There are many, many purchase orders, Your Honor, but those purchase orders are all creatures of the 6-5 and 6-9 contracts.
Those are the terms of the purchase orders. Right. I appreciate that. But there are actually many entities that entered into contracts with Nelson Auto for purchases of individual and groups of vehicles.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, absolutely. We have to take that as true, right? It's asserted in the complaint, and you're looking for a Rule 12 affirmance. So, I mean, I can't understand why you would quibble with that.
No, and I'm agreeing with you, Your Honor.
Okay.
That is the case.
So if that's the course of things, and we have these subsequent purchase agreements, under what authority does the DOA then negotiate and hold an arbitration on behalf of those individual subdivisions? Getting back to your point about privity, because they had the statutory DOA, had the statutory authority to enter into the global contracts. I appreciate that. But did they have the authority to then enter into and negotiate the reimbursements for all of those separate individual political entities that followed up with purchase agreements?
Yes, and the answer is yes, because privity is not just a creature of contract. Privity is a
common law. So you're telling me that they did not have statutory authority or contractual authority, DOA.
I'm telling you that they had more than that. So the cooperative.
Well, before you get to more than that, start with where is the statutory authority for DOA to enter into this arbitration on behalf of all of these individual and separate political entities?
So I believe that 16C.105, which is the statute that authorizes the agreements themselves, is the beginning of the authority of the state to do that. And the secondary part of that, which I think is the most critical in the analysis of privity, is that privity is not constrained to a creature of contract.
And I understand that. But you claimed that contract was one of the bases for your privity argument. And if you're relying on the authority of DOA to enter into the contracts, I'm not following you. And perhaps you want to persuade me on that.
Yep. And I believe that it is simply a function of 16C.105 that when it allows the state to do that, and when the state's interest is in enforcing that contract, it therefore must have the right to take steps to enforce the contract. The secondary principle is, as a matter of common law, privity exists anytime a party is acting in the interests of someone else. And we know that that happened here because we know that the subdivisions received money directly through Judge Boylan's order.
Right. So, and thank you for that, because I think it's important to note that there have been a lot of checks cut by Nelson Auto in this case. We do have 120 political entities that did not receive anything, at least not in Exhibit A, to the arbitration award. So what representation then did DOA do with regard to them?
Certainly. So as I mentioned before, Your Honor, and allow me to make a few points in response to your question. As I mentioned before, the state has an interest in ensuring full compliance with its contracts. So number one, that directly benefits the subdivisions. But number two, the argument that some entities were paid and some entities weren't is essentially a collateral attack on the award itself. And what we know is that Judge Boylan's order found for Nelson Auto on at least one of the four claims.
Mr. Norrie, though, in terms of the arbitration award, you're acknowledging, at least for the point of our consideration, that the parties received notice of the arbitration because they received an award. There wasn't any formal notice. I mean, are you acknowledging no formal notice given to any of the public entities, right?
I am acknowledging that, Your Honor.
And your position would then be we didn't have to because they're under the umbrella.
Correct, Your Honor. And because the state acted in privity with those subdivisions. And if I could get back to Judge Bratvold's question for just a brief minute. So we know that Judge Boylan found for Nelson Auto on at least one of the four claims. So tied into this issue of, well, gee, some subdivisions got money and some didn't. It's essentially attacking the content of Judge Boylan's decision. And we know that the award says, I am deciding all issues and all decisions. And we know that none of the political subdivisions here, when they received notice of this lawsuit, none of them chose to intervene. They all
so
received
why,
notice
why is
of
that
this
legally
lawsuit.
Significant? It's mentioned repeatedly in your brief, but I don't see any case law telling me that that's significant in a False Claims Act case. Because right. Why would they intervene? They are actually the real party in interest. There's no point to intervention, is there?
They are the real party in interest. I think number one, as a practical matter, it emphasizes the fact that this is a second bite at the apple for Mr. Kleiber to receive a windfall. Not for the benefit of the subdivision.
But again, you misstate things because under the False Claims Act, Mr. Kleiber is not the benefited party predominantly. It is the state of Minnesota and the individual political entities, correct? They
correct,
are the real parties in interest.
Absolutely, they are the real parties in interest, but Mr. Kleiber will also receive payment. And I do believe
if
that-
If he's successful. At this point, all we're deciding yes. is whether he states a claim.
Yes. And I do believe that at least in the Federal False Claims Act, if the government participates, their percentage of recovery can be greater than if they do not participate. So at least in the federal False Claims Act, there is an incentive for the government to participate to increase their award, if any. And so if the same is true under the Minnesota Act, if a municipality felt that it had been wronged and it felt it would have an interest in participating to increase its recovery and minimize the recovery of the relator.
But I guess my point, Mr. Norrie, is that the failure of the state and the other political entities, their failure to intervene in this case, doesn't go to under Rule 12 to whether the relator here states a claim, correct?
I think it is relevant in the practical sense of observing privity.
So I think you're saying it is not relevant to whether they state a claim. I don't see a case in privity either that says that that's relevant. Maybe I missed it.
No, okay. You did not miss it, Your Honor.
Okay.
You did not miss it.
As Judge Bradfold is presiding judge, I have a question for Mr. Norrie. I see that we were running into Mr. Polklich's time. Is it okay if I ask my question?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we had set up separate times. I apologize.
We did. I believe we did, Your
okay.
Honor.
Okay. Go ahead, Judge Riley. Yeah.
So you would agree that the False Claims Act and QI-TEM proceedings can be really important for making sure that fraudsters are discovered. Would you agree with that?
I do, Your Honor.
So Mr. Becker argued that by Admin and Nelson entering into this arbitration award, you're kind of doing an end run around the False Claims Act and what Mr. Cleaver is trying to do to get full recompense. So how do you respond to Mr. Becker's argument?
That Your Honor, this is exactly the case for the application of res judicata, because this is a matter that has been pursued by the state acting for the benefit of its subdivisions. And as you observed, more than $1 million has been recovered. It has also directly involved the criminal prosecution of Mr. Warner, and it has been the subject of a massive amount of media attention. So there is, in essence, there is no hiding anything, and this is the case that's going to bring things to light. This has already come to light. And with that, my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Norrie. All right, I think we're ready for you, Mr. Polklich.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. I feel like I should stand, but is it okay if I sit?
Please go ahead and stay seated.
Thank you. Your Honor's last question concerning the Minnesota False Claims Act, I think is an important one, because it does serve an important interest in this case. The issue that I think that was sort of missed is that the state of Minnesota actually acted as the prosecuting attorney in connection with this matter. These matters were prosecuted and these matters were heard. Judge Boylan did consider the evidence. There were multiple audits and awards were given. The argument that I understood that the appellant was making was that there was no standing on behalf of the state of Minnesota to pursue those claims. And I don't think that that is at least that's not my reading of the statute. The state of Minnesota has the ability to pursue claims pursuant to the Minnesota False Claims Act or pursuant to any other common law claim that it may have. They adjudicated and heard, Judge Boylan heard all of the claims in connection with this matter. And I think that the important point in connection with that is that the ruling wrapped up everything in connection with this case. The state of Minnesota had the ability to pursue the claim. The state of Minnesota did pursue the claim. The state of Minnesota did act as the prosecuting attorney in connection with the claim. It doesn't need to be styled as a claim under the False Claims Act to resolve everything. In arbitration, the parties can, they can label claims any way that they want to, but in connection with this claim, the state clearly acted on behalf of itself and on behalf of the counties and the attorneys. Now, All of the claims arise, as everybody's agreed, under this cooperative purchasing venture. Had Nelson Auto entered into separate agreements with the counties without the cooperative purchasing venture, there'd be no claim. The claim would not exist but for the cooperative purchasing agreement that provided the basis upon which the pricing was structured. The parties are free under contract in the United States to enter into any sort of agreement that they want to. The only thing that made this claim actionable is the fact that the cooperative purchasing venture agreement existed. And I see that I am now running out of time, so I do appreciate this, and it was a good Zoom experience. Thank you, Your Honors.
I am glad to hear that. Thank you very much. So Mr. Becker, I think we're ready as soon as the clock is reset at 5 minutes for you to have your 5 minutes of rebuttal.
May it please the court. What I'd say is what this case is about is giving the cities and the counties who are the actual victims a chance to advance their own claims using their own voice instead of a voice that they didn't choose, which was admin. And so that's really what this is about. And these cities and counties and these other state agencies that had no participation in the ADR process, they need to have their chance to present their claim. And it's fundamental as that. Admin did not represent their interests in the ADR process, and we briefed it extensively. There's a very specific test that you use for the doctrine of representational privity for purposes of a res judicata analysis. And that is articulated in the Lemmer case and the Parada case. And the Lemmer case says that there's three factors to be considered. And that's whether the party to be estopped, and that's, for example, the city of Lakeville, did they have a controlling participation in the first action? I submit to you, they didn't know about the first action, couldn't have controlled anything. The second factor, whether they had an active self-interest in the previous litigation. Again, they didn't know about it, so they couldn't be active to protect their interests. And three, did they have a right to appeal? And we briefed that extensively, and if they weren't a party and they didn't have their own basis in that underlying ADR, they I don't see how they could have appealed. Under the Parada test, another case on this issue, the analysis is whether the party in the first action that is purported to represent the others act with accountability to the others. And, you know, we've heard the argument that, well, admin did get some extra money and, you know, that's not a bad thing, but that's not the test. The test is whether they acted with accountability. And the award is very clear that in the ADR, admin argued that the city's and the county's money on the GPC issue should actually go to Ford, even though the state contracts couldn't be clearer, that money is to go to the cities and the counties. And so based on that issue alone, we know that admin did not act with representational privity to meet the res judicata test. And so there's no assertion of contractual or statutory authority that to me holds any water. And then on the basis of the representational privity analysis that we're required to use, they don't meet any of the tests. So on that factor, the ADR shouldn't be given any res judicata effect. And I've briefed it extensively in the case about the lack of subject matter jurisdiction, because in order to have a binding arbitration process, there has to be consent by the contracting parties. And none of the cities or counties or non-admin state agencies signed the agreement to arbitrate or do ADR of their claims. And that's just fundamental. Without that agreement, there's no, that ADR provider did not have jurisdiction to decide anything with respect to those parties. It just didn't. And then to respond to Mr. Puklich's point about the prosecuting authority, we've briefed this extensively, but I want to just make it clear that the false claim statute establishes who can be the prosecuting attorney. For state, it would be the attorney general, and they have to exercise that power as the prosecuting attorney to make a False Claims Act. And the way they do that is they say, I'm the attorney general, I'm pursuing you for false claims liability under the act, I'm the prosecuting attorney. That didn't happen in the ADR.
So Mr. Becker, can you comment on Mr. Norris's remark that under the Federal False Claims Act, the government has an incentive to intervene in a False Claims Act case? Is that true under the state act? And
It's really not at all. What I can say is—
Well, when you say really not at all, are you talking about the Minnesota Federal False Claims Act?
And in particular, I'm talking about this particular case. You have to realize this is a big undertaking to do this case. We have 3,000 contracts, and some of the overcharges are relatively modest individually. But in the aggregate, it's a very large amount. So individually, the cities and counties have to weigh, because you know they don't have staff attorneys. They have to go hire for public bid. They go and hire their attorneys. Is it worth it to them, or are they better off having a key TAM relator do this out of their goodwill? And so I think economically, there wouldn't be any incentive for the cities and counties to do this alone.
Well, if I can just clarify one thing, you say that Mr. Kleber is doing this out of his goodwill, but that he does, in fact, if he's successful, he gets some remuneration, right, under the statute.
He does, and the statute provides for greater remuneration if there's no intervention, but there also is less if there is intervention. But part of the statutory process is you file it under seal and allow cities and counties and state agencies to decide if they would like to intervene or not. So they've, by not intervening, they've elected based on their own cost benefit analysis whether they should or not. I don't think you can read anything into their motivations by the fact that they haven't intervened. I think that's just a non-issue. I don't think it means anything.
Well, with that, Mr. Becker, I think that your rebuttal time has elapsed, and I'm just checking with my panel members to see if there is anything additional. Since this is a complicated case, it's not surprising that we went over at a few minutes here and there. But I want to extend the thanks to the panel then. It looks like no one does have a further question. To all the lawyers in this case, it's very much appreciated your advocacy, both in writing as well as orally today. And with that, I think this matter is concluded for oral argument.